Hello and welcome to Hunt, Find, Alert, the Canine Search and Rescue podcast, where we discuss everything related to the world of canine search and rescue. I'm your host, Zephyrin Allen, and thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate everyone who's taken the time to listen to the episodes. I've gotten a lot of really positive feedback, and just know I do read all the feedback that I get. So I really appreciate the folks that are out there that take the time to send me feedback. So if you have any other feedback, feel free to send it to me, either positive or negative. I'm always happy to read it and hear it and listen to it. And if you have show suggestions, feel free to send me those as well. You can send me that information on the Hunt Find Alert Facebook page. And if you have some good suggestions and if there's enough of them, we'll try to schedule some folks on to talk about some of the suggestions that you all provide. So with that little leading, I want to jump to our episode for today, which is one that I'm particularly excited about. It's something that our team has been using the last few years. And I'm sure other teams have been using it as well. And hopefully through this episode, maybe a few other teams decide to use it. But it's a process that we use to evaluate dogs. And so to discuss this process, I have one of the authors of the process, of the scale, I should say. His name is Dr. Mark Mosselet, and he has been kind enough to join us today. Mark, thank you so much for joining us, and how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Just a little bit cold up here where I'm at. But also, thank you very much for inviting me and also David Brunell. David couldn't be here, so I've got to do the lifting today, and I hope I'll do well by David today.
Very good. Very good. I'm sure you will. Well, we appreciate you taking the time to join. So what we like to do, Mark, is we like to understand a little bit about our guests and kind of where they're from, what their background is. And then from there, we like to switch into their experience of working with dogs. So if you wouldn't mind tell us a little bit about your professional background, what you currently do, maybe what you've done in the past, and then we'll switch over to your dog experience.
Oh, great. Well, first of all, I am a professor of criminal justice and security up here at a small college up in Maine. This is my 10th year teaching up here. Prior to that, I was doing a little bit of consulting in, you know, kind of the canine world, setting up canine programs, because I just finished up before that with a security company, international security company. We did a lot of canine deployments overseas, especially explosive canines, drug canines. The region that we work in, of course, was Iraq and Afghanistan, a little bit of Africa and some in South America. That is, you know, one of the bulk of my experience with canine was actually being director of the program at the state side, but making sure that everything was taken care of overseas. Prior to that, I had also been teaching at another college. And then I did 20 years in the Houston Police Department, Houston, Texas. Part of my assignment there, I actually got to run the patrol canine detail for quite a few years. Great experience working with dogs. And, you know, previous to that, I'd gone to college and been in the military right out of high school. So I've got some mileage on me. Well, you know, that's the Reader's Digest version of where I was and where I am right now.
All right. Very good. So apparently you are a man who likes extremes. So you went from the extreme heat of Houston to the extreme cold of Maine.
Yeah. A little stop in between, a little bit of Midwest stuff too. So, it's a pleasure to be back in New England. I grew up in New England, as you can probably tell from my accent. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I spent 20 plus years in Texas. So I say fixin' to and y'all, and people look at me with a Yankee accent saying that, and they just kind of roll their eyes. So, but, you know, I can talk Texan, I guess, a little bit, and I can still talk Yankee. So everything's fine in that regards.
Yeah, very good. I have to tell you a story. A few years ago, I was up in Maine for business, and I think I was in the city of Portland, but I could be wrong. It's been a few years now. And I was walking out of the hotel, and I think it was February, maybe early February, mid-February. And I was walking out of the hotel, so I was outside, and there was a guy building an ice sculpture outside. And I just had to ask him, because I'm from Texas, I just had to ask him. I said, how long is this going to be here for you to be building this gigantic thing outdoors? And he said, oh, it'll be here for another few months. And at that point, I knew that I would never live in the state of Maine.
we got plenty of that ice sculpture stuff. They last quite a while. So
yeah. Very good. So let's jump into your dog work. So you mentioned you've kind of done some consultant work. Would you mind digging into that just a bit more? Exactly what did you do? Where did you supply dogs to? You mentioned Iraq and Afghanistan and kind of some, give it a little bit more detail there.
Yeah, well, actually, I was teaching college, and David, and we'll talk a little bit about David Brunell's background in a little bit, but you know, I come to know David, and I'll go through the history of that. But David had actually been gone overseas to run a number of programs over in Iraq, explosive detection, narcotics detection, and the like. And the company that hired David, I was teaching at the time, but they kept talking to me about certain things, the screening instrument that we'd used and selecting dogs. And I really got tired of the pro bono work. And I said, look, you've got to find something for me, or else, you know, I'm going to do something else. So the company, it was a security company, international security company out of Washington, D.C. And they brought me on to take over the canine contract. The company had won a contract with NASA, all the NASA sites. And as government contracts sometimes do, there's some things that there were some glitches with it. But they kept me on basically doing marketing for the canine portion. And then later on, I took over as a director of all the canine for the company. And specifically, I was tasked with, there was a number of dogs that were overseas that were not doing very well within the combat zones. And David and I kind of felt that we perfected selecting dogs so they would work in probably the harshest conditions possible, explosives, windstorms, heat. And so that became my major task, is, you know, doing all of the supply, the dog related equipment, but also working with the contracts. We were handling $1 million contracts related to canine detection. So I spent a number of years doing that. And so after that, I left the company because of, it was just a lot of stress. So I went and did, you know, I left there and did some consulting on my own. And actually, we were designing some academic programs to get the best out of handlers. We looked at handlers and said, what was the weakness with handlers? So I started working on some academic skills-based programs for that. So I actually wrote a major teaching program for that. And, you know, we presented a couple of people. We're still doing some things with that, without getting into, client at this time. So, but, you know, the large portion of my security work was in really, you know, making sure that the dogs that were going overseas were actually going to succeed overseas. And we'll go a little bit into that, I guess, when we talk about the instrument.
Mm-hmm. All right. Very good. And then all that was in addition to your time with Houston PD. And sounds like you ran a dog there for quite a while. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. If anybody knows anything about the, I think it's the Garcia lawsuit about canine handlers and police being paid for the taking care of the dog time. Well, Houston went through a major change with their dogs. They decided to, there was a lot of the dog programs down in Houston at the time weren't being, for lack of a better word, they weren't being supervised as they should have been. There was narcotics, there was the airport explosives, and patrol and the like. And so what the department decided to do, reorganize the canine, and I stepped in as a supervisor. I was not granted a patrol canine at the time. And in fact, I will have to say this, I didn't really want one, because as a supervisor, I wanted to supervise the unit, not be running a dog. Through the course of running that, later on, there was a decision made to assign me as a patrol dog handler. And I actually went through the, Houston had a 15-week patrol dog handler school. And so I successfully went through with that. They gave me a Czechoslovakian German Shepherd. We got that bang up street dog, a wonderful street dog. And, you know, it's just, we had some success with that. But basically, my main thrust at that point was to also supervise the unit, not to be the primary unit going out on these search teams. And we had a number of good, solid, excellent handlers with excellent dogs. Very, very happy to have been a part of that unit.
All right, very good. Would you mind go ahead and let's dig into David's background?
Mm-hmm. David's background, a little bit similar to mine. I mean, he went into the military, except he did go the canine MP route. with the U.S. military. Came out of the military and started working in security, but then he started working in the search and rescue in and around the Dallas area. And, you know, was very much involved with, I think, Search One Response Team out of Dallas. That's how I met David. But, you know, he did that for a number of years. And then with the stuff that was going on post, you know, 2001, got involved in the security world. He actually, I want to say he worked for me, but I want to say he worked with me. Initially, when he went over there, he was helping set up their program, but he later became a program and project manager. David was all throughout the country of Iraq. He spent a lot of time in Baghdad proper, but he also was setting up programs, for explosive detection programs, for a number of commercial entities, oil companies and stuff like that. They didn't want people coming in and blowing up their, you know, their oil fields or anything like that. Also, the United Nations security for that with the K-9s and a number of other entities, you know, non-government agencies, non-government organizations, and setting that up. So if you look at David, you know, he has some background in security in Europe also, but the major thrust of you know, almost, I want to say about 15 years of actually being over there in, you know, the combat zone and working, you know, with security, with K-9 security, but at a trainer, project and program manager. You know, now he's back here in the United States and he's running the Ground Zero's Director of K-9 Training for the Ground Zero Foundation up in Oklahoma, which is a nonprofit designed to send dogs out, train dogs and get them out into working hands that are going to work on disasters up there.
All right, very good. So one of the things we try to do is just give context. And I should say, I'm sure the listeners at this point are probably wondering why we keep mentioning David. We'll get to that here in just a minute because it's probably a valid question. But I'd like to give context, if you wouldn't mind, of just the breeds that you've worked in. You mentioned explosives, you've mentioned narcotics and a couple of things. Just kind of talk about, just really quickly, and what breeds have you worked with? What disciplines have you worked with? And then you mentioned Iraq and Afghanistan. Any other places that you've deployed dogs in addition to the city of Houston?
No. I just mostly, you know, kind of as a program manager. As far as deploying, you know, in Houston, what was interesting about that was getting the patrol dog, very comprehensive training program, not only for, you know, we talk about, you know, going out and, you know, doing bad guys and bad girls, but all the major things expected of a dog, whether it was air scouting, air searching, air scenting or whatever, as well as tracking. Also evidence, all dogs were trained to find firearms. What we found out, two of our dogs, my dog and another one of my trainer's dogs, we found that we could also kind of flip a switch on them depending on the command, and we trained them to find cadaver. So we got involved with that. And so that, you know, at the time we were running basically Mals, Dutchies, and just German Shepherds. And my street dog was itself a German Shepherd. Now, later on, after I got out of that realm, I started a little bit with the Texas Task Force with a Malinois, but I left the state before I really got, this was back in the 2000, you know, 9/11 days. Some of the team did go to up to New York City. I was part of the team at the time, but no deployment. The dog wasn't ready. And so a couple of years I was gone from Texas, so I, you know, kind of withdrew from there. The last working dog that I had was a Malinois that was trained in cadaver work and never really got any deployments with that dog. Solid dog as far as, you know, cadaver work, human remains work. But that was the last working dog that I had under my, you know, under my handling.
All right. Very good. So then let's get to the purpose of the episode and let's give the context of why we keep mentioning David. So both you and David developed a scale to evaluate dogs. So let's start there. Tell us a little bit about the scale and maybe why you all took the time to develop it.
Well, let's flip your questions here. Let me go back to why we developed it. Okay. All right. So, let me give you a little context here because it goes back to my police days, but there I was working in the Houston Police Department and I got a call from my homicide division. And they said, hey, can your dogs find lost kids? Can they find Alzheimer's patients? And can they you know, find cadavers. I said, well, I don't know about the cadaver part. And I said, why? What's going on here? Well, apparently the Houston Homicide Division had been approached by a search and rescue group, which says that the Houston Police Patrol canines weren't able to do lost children Alzheimer's because they bite them when they got there. And one of the things I learned from my trainers, I had some very, very good trainers. They said, if it's human and alive, we can find it. And they proved it day after day. I mean, one of our patrol dogs went out looking for an Alzheimer's patient. And all it was track, you know, basically track an innocent for the person. And they did. So anyways, I had a question. I called my friend up in Dallas, Diane and Kevin Henry, who were involved in Schutzen. I'd known them for Schutzen. And I said, look, what's the search and rescue stuff about? And they said, well, you need to talk to this guy named David Purnell. So I went up there and I went up to Dallas and talked and met with David. I brought my trainer up there. David kind of sized us up. You know, were we going to be the police officers that knew everything and didn't want to listen to anybody? Luckily, you know, I brought one of my best trainers, Ken Ray Hartman, with me. And Ken Ray is a sponge. He's old school, but he loves to learn stuff. And so they hit it off, and we hit it off with David. David explained stuff to me. He looked at our dogs, and by that time, when I went back to Houston, we started to do a lot of consulting with David. And what he did was he actually introduced us to human remains. He saw the dogs that we're working with, and so he introduced that to us. So we learned from David. So I, you know, this professional relationship I have with David started then. All right, I am getting kind of lengthy here, but you'll be doing your editing. So over the time, David would ask me, he said, hey, would you come on out to, he was doing the training seminars. And I said, yeah. So we went out to a training seminar a couple years, you know, I was still in the police department, but I wasn't doing dogs anymore. But I went out to the seminar with David. And one of the problems we saw was we were there and people were, oh, they're all energetic about the training seminar. They're going to learn this, they're going to learn that. Human remains, tracking, all this sort of stuff. But what was going on was the people were coming up and saying to David, they said, well, my dog does this, my dog does this. And what we realized is that there was a lot of weaknesses to the dogs. Mm-hmm. The handlers were coming in, they're all energetic, but they were showing up with the wrong equipment. So we're driving back, and David will say he remembers it differently, but we're driving back, and David said, you know, there's a real problem here. He said, you know, the people don't understand. They're not showing up with the right equipment. They're not showing up with the right dog. And I said to David, and this is how I remember it. I said, well, it's your fault, David. And he said, what? And I said, it's your fault. I said, you're sitting here telling me about it. I know about it, but we're not telling the people what they need to be bringing to these training seminars. We tell them to bring a nice leash. We tell them to bring a nice crate. We tell them to bring the water bowl, but we don't tell them to bring a dog that wants to do this work. And from that, we sat down, and this is kind of the, you know, people said when we came up with this Brunel Mosley scale for evaluating dogs, you know, who the hell are you guys? If you read the original deal, we said, we're just people interested in canines, and David's, you know, knowledge is, you know, I mean, exponentially lot more than mine because of the number of dogs he worked with. But what we did was we looked at the best practices. We said, what do we, you know, kind of reverse engineer? So we came up with this thing. We said, well, they've got to be sociable. We had problems with dogs going to training and then they end up biting people. Okay. Or they get into a dog fight. The other thing was, you know, we said, what about their nerve strength? You know, we know what hunters do. They do the gunfire test, but what are these dogs going to be exposed to? You know, What are they not searching when they get to a slick floor? And so we started breaking that down. But one of the things, and I want to be really, you know, really emphasize this point, is we looked at what the good people were doing and writing up, and we said, we owe an extreme amount of debt to the people that have been out there working with dogs for years and years and years, and we came across them. You know, people we talked to, I mean, Shirley Hammond, you know, comes to mind out of California, sitting there talking and, but nobody was putting it to paper. That was the issue. And if, you know, you can tell I like to talk, but I also like to put stuff to paper. I don't mind doing that and writing that up. And so we went through some categories. Pat Hahn, who was at Penn Vet, and she read over the stuff. And so we produced this document, which basically broke down sociability, drive and nerve strength. But then also we know when we wanted to measure this stuff, we wanted it to only measure that variable. So in other words, a lot of people and police officers used to do this. They would test the dog and drive. They would say they do a gunfire test while the dog was doing an attack. That is multiple variables. It's a pursuit, it's prey, gunfire, nerve strength, all at the same time. We said, what if we just took a dog, put it out on a leash, and did a gunfire? What would the dog do? Would it flee or would it stay there? Would it be neutral? Mm-hmm. You know. So what we did was we took basic elements. It had to be sociable to other dogs and people, because in the industry, coming from search and rescue, you may get injured on a rubble pile, and somebody has to take your dog off. We didn't need the dog going into a protection deal. So we kind of broke, reverse engineered. What is it that would be successful? And some people were already doing that, but they'd never done it in a systematic test. And that's what we did out of that. We built it into a systematic test.
Okay. Well, yeah, that makes perfect sense. And about what year did you all create the document?
About 1999. Okay. It's been over 20 years. Yeah.
All right. And so then once y'all published it, it sounds like you mentioned y'all may have gotten a little bit of criticism. What was the reception from the search and rescue and detection dog community in general?
Well, it's kind of interesting because the first time that we used it, but we didn't get any credit for it, was actually when they were screening dogs for the Texas Task Force. They actually used the screening instrument. And there was some question. I think Suzanne Brown, who was one of the canine coordinators at the time, we're talking about weighting different variables and stuff like that, but they ran the dogs through it. And I'm going to tell you that what was so instrumental about that test, which Texas Task Force did, is because they said, we see some weaknesses and we want to make the Texas Task Force really stand out. I mean, Virginia was doing their thing. California's doing their thing. So Texas, and it also, you have to kind of look at the, political situation. The president was now Bush, who was from Texas and stuff like that. But they decided the Texas Task Force, what it was at the time, was questionable about how good the dogs were going to perform that were there already. And so they came up with that, and they put that, they did the test for the dogs that were there. Many, I think it was all the dogs were passing the test. They had the sociability and the drive and the nerve strength. And then, word kind of got out, and then, people said, looked at it. I even heard some of the police departments, they wouldn't acknowledge it, but they said, oh yeah, we're testing for nerve strength. Well, I had been with police departments before. Nobody ever said nerve strength. So I think, well, that's where they picked up. But we didn't care because we published it. It was for free. There was no money made on this deal. And, we talked to other people and they said, you're right. If they pass through these things, we're going to have a strong candidate for search and rescue. It doesn't mean it's going to succeed. We evaluated the dogs on, whether they were high, medium, low, or whatever, but it got out there. Some people came back and said, we've been doing this for years. And I said, fine, that's great. I didn't feel like I had to defend anything. And we asked people, they said, look, if you want to add something to this, or you want to see something, it's a fluid document and you can do that. So we never had any problem. We ended up publishing, I think, in like a fire rescue magazine or something. So that really, that's where it got out into kind of the public realm. It's gotten out there and it's been out there for 20 years and some people are using it. They may not, call it the Brunel-Moseley scale or test or anything like that or assessment. That's fine. But if you look at some of these teams, they're doing sociability, they're doing nerve strength, and they're doing drive testing.
So, all right. Very good. So did y'all use this testing for the dog that you were deploying overseas?
100%. And I'm going to tell you why. When David got overseas, before I think I got involved with the security company, but Dave was saying, he said, they would have rockets coming in, early 2000 Iraq, it was a whole mess going on. But that impacted nerve strength. It impacted nerve strength of soldiers and Marines and, mm-hmm. and security people too. But one of the things is there was a lot of failure rate. We estimated 25 to 30% dogs were seen sent back over back to America. And so when I got involved in it, when I took over as direct canine, I specifically said that I would be going out and using this instrument. The reason we did this is that I would use the instrument. I would go to a vendor. I would look at the dogs and tell them, this is what I do. And if a vendor said, well, we're not interested in doing it this way, then I didn't have anything to do with the vendor because we knew this would work. And the other thing is when David would get the dogs overseas and some of the people that he trained, they would assess the dogs in overseas to make sure. One of the things that we did do, we kept the stats on it. And I'm going to say this, and some people might challenge it. I said we probably had a 5% loss of dogs overseas. David is adamant today that it was probably 0% once we instituted this screening instrument. We instituted it in the United States, collected the dogs, made sure they were, you know, at least, you know, trained to get ready to go overseas, and then David would test them after they acclimated overseas, and he wasn't sending any dogs back.
So that's what I was going to ask. When you say lost, that means dogs that washed out of the program, is that right?
Yeah, dogs that would wash out of the program, yeah. Now, okay. We might have had something, you know, maybe genetic or some sort of injury or something, but as far as the drive and nerve strength, and that's not to say we sent over, you know, the NFL caliber dogs. That's what we tried to send over, but you might have a, you know, Division I football player dog that went overseas, not as quite as sharp as that NFL player, but these dogs all, when they were evaluated, as either outstanding or excellent candidate. Once in a while, very good, but anything that was considered to be fair was not. I did not take, you know, I mean, these dogs were costing us money, and you know that as the representative for the company, you know, I had to, you know, I want to make sure if I'm going to send over 13, 14 dogs, those dogs had to be able to get on the ground, get trained up, and get ready to go because of the mission was so important. So, and the proof was in the pudding. Every one of the vendors that worked with us, they knew what we wanted. They might have not liked it because they wanted to churn out dogs and send them over. I will tell you this, that there are contracts that I did observe that dogs did go overseas. They shouldn't have gone overseas. They had the flight response on one of the tests we did was the noise response. Mm-hmm. I find that to be a lot of times with noise, whether you call it a gunfire test, loud banging noise or machinery. If the dog's got the flight response, I don't have time to train that dog. I don't have a year to train that dog out of that flight response. It's either gut or it doesn't. And yeah. I'm here to tell you that I watched an evaluation one time, and there's no secret about it. I watched, if the dogs weren't on a leash, they would have fled, and those dogs actually were deployed overseas by another company. They weren't deployed by me. So, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, so if you were to put a finger in the air and just guesstimate how many dogs that both between you and David, y'all ran through the screening for your overseas work, what do you think it'd be?
In the hundreds.
Okay. And your wash rate sounds like less than 5%. So sounds like David would say 0%, but less than 5%.
Yeah. Once we instituted the screening program. Yeah. Yeah. And I was supplying, I also had contracts. David was in Iraq. But we had the Kabul embassy also at the same time. And we also had some mine detection dogs and stuff like that going overseas. So that was, you know, again, those dogs, the vendors that we dealt with, they had to put their dogs through the screening instrument. When they got overseas, they were expected to, the people that were like in Afghanistan were expected to reevaluate those dogs and make sure that they were on task.
All right. Very good. And then I'll make an assumption. Hopefully it's not incorrect, but I'm going to assume that David has continued to use this screening process and the search and rescue work. He continues to do both right now at Ground Zero. I'm going to assume he's still using this process to evaluate his dog.
No. I got to tell you, Zephyr, that I was there last week and he made me do an evaluation of a dog.
Okay.
I don't know if he was testing me to see if I remembered, you know, I said no, but no, he, you know, exactly. We went through all of the steps. We may be old dogs, but you know, we're going to still use the old techniques too. And it was fun to do it. I mean, we were talking and what we did was we compared our scores and we were generally, actually, I think I was harder on the dogs than David was, which is unusual. Usually David's harder on the dogs and I give a better grade, but we had what we call, you know, rate of reliability. And that is that if David sees something and says that dog is, you know, really top in prey drive, I better be saying the same thing. If I'm saying it's mediocre in prey drive, we want to know why. But most right. of the time, and a lot of, you know, people look at the instrument and they'll have an agreement. They'll be off, you know, off by just a, you know, percentage or something like that, but not much.
All right. Very good. So then with all that lead up, let's get into the actual test and what it is. Mm-hmm. So let's start. You've kind of mentioned it, but let's just break it down really quickly. What are the components of the test and how important are they? Are they equally important or is it very dependent on what the job the dog is going to do?
Well, yes and no. Okay, let's talk about the sociability test, okay? Hey. That's the first part we're looking for. Why don't we, you know, we're reading the dog on sociability. We're tying a dog out. If you're going to give me, if I'm going to test your dog, I'm taking your dog and Zephyr, you can go off, go down to the donut shop and get a cup of coffee or whatever and do that. We're going to test. I'm going to look to see if the if it's sociable with me. Is it coming up to me? What's it look like? Or is its ears, you know, you're looking at the dog behavior. The ears are flattened and or the lips are curled and it's growling. You know, we don't have that sociability because where are they going to be working? They're going to be working around the public, especially in search and rescue disaster. They're going to be a lot of people coming in. So we look at the sociability. We look at with other dogs. All right. Now, one of the things that I will tell, and I talk to my my students about this, is that sometimes you have a very assertive dog. Some of the patrol dogs that come in for police work, they're assertive because that's their makeup, and they're not sociable with other people and may not be sociable dog. That doesn't mean that dog can't work. It's just mm-hmm. that you got to now take, where are you going to put that dog? Are you going to put it into a public environment or maybe go into a wilderness situation or maybe into kind of a, you know, whatever, you know, I want to say, you know, an apprehension dog. It's, you know, there's dogs that are just very, very, very confident, and they're also very aggressive. But so we want to make sure it's not really aggressive. It's sociable with other dogs, and it's neutral to people, and somebody can walk over there and leash it up. And we want to know, you know, a dog that looks like it's not stressed. So if one of the things I do the sociability first, and a lot of people don't realize this, that if the dog is stressed by other dogs or it's stressed by another human handling it, then that I've had dogs, you know, try to, you know, flee. I'm no longer going to test that dog because that's not fair. The dog is saying, I don't want to be here. I can't force that dog into testing. So we stop the testing right there. Mm-hmm. So the sociability is real important. And we do that first because I want to know if the dog is going to continue with the test. You know, Johnny goes to school the first day. You know, if Johnny's, you know, wetting his pants and, you know, wanting to go home, how can I teach Johnny when that's all, you know, that's he's worried about? So the same thing with the dog. So sociability to me is real, real important. And mainly because we've started a lot of this in the search and rescue, in the disaster world, where people are around all the time, you know, firemen, rescue workers, everybody. And so the sociability, and they're going to be around other dogs. You're going to have to be loading up side by side with a dog and not always going to have a crate. So that was the first part of the test.
So on the sociability testing, one of the things that the evaluation mentions is that the actual handler of the dog should walk away and then to wait a minute before starting mm-hmm. the test. Is there a specific reason why you want the handler totally out of the picture?
Yeah, because there's that attachment there. And, you know, some of the dogs, especially if somebody's coming in search and rescue, and they, you know, they have the dog and they've had it for a while. Well, you know, again, when that person did, they have the confidence, you know, kind of the old thing about traveling up and down the lead, there's the confidence there, you know, to reassure. If they walk off, what we want is, you know, a dog that's, you know, it's going to operate without somebody being there. A lot of these dogs, it goes back to what we did overseas. We assigned handlers to them. But, you know, the thing is that handler goes off on leave. If we need a bomb dog out there on a stick to check vehicles for bombs, I'm going to put that with a dog with another handler. It's not going to, if it's going to shut down because, you know, dad's gone back to the United States, you know, or mom's gone back to the United States, then I can't, you know, that doesn't do me any good. I've got to have an explosive detection dog that can work with anybody. In the search and rescue, I know a lot of people, you know, they bring their own dogs and, you know, they've got something vested in that. And so, but we want to remove that. You know, we're going to want to remove that attachment deal. You know, we're sending the dog off to college. Mom and dad, you know, see you later, son, see you later, and go out there, and we want to see if you can do the work without mom and dad being around.
All right, very good. So before we jump to the next component, I failed to ask, what age do you want to do this test at? Is there a, do you want to do it at 3 months, 9 months, or somewhere in between?
Yeah, we never, this was never scheduled for the puppies. The way we set this up was a year old. Okay. We wanted to make sure that the, and I'm glad you asked this, because first of all, it's going to be vet checked, and then all of a sudden, it's going to be health checked, and there's not going to be anything wrong with it. We look at a year, the dog is still a juvenile, but there's a lot of tendencies that are coming out of that point. And many of the people that are bringing the dogs want the dogs to go into this work, they're doing all the sociability stuff. They're doing some things with it, but they're letting the dog be a juvenile, being a puppy and doing a little bit of growing up. Ultimately, we've deployed dogs, at 18 months old. And I don't think that's the best situation. Maybe 2 years, but my cutoff is the dog has to be 12 months, 13 months old before I start doing the testing.
Okay, very good. So then let's jump to the next component, motivation and drive. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, really the motivation and drive testing, and there's a number of people out there that talk about different drive. Kevin Cicello is one, he's out in New Mexico. Kevin's talked about motivation and drive. But we start breaking those variables down. What are the important ones? Does the dog like to play or play drive? What's play drive? Well, it engages with the handler, engages with other people and plays, throwing the ball, pulling on the tug. Why is that so important? The play drive, we want to see it. It's not going to be overly the biggest thing is essential to, the search and rescue community. But that is play for dog is stress relief, okay? Mm-hmm. You and I work hard, and then we go and we play. So we look at play drive. The other thing is we're taking advantage of the prey drive, the visual thing, going after an object, because that is real important for training, especially if you do, if you want to do like a tracking dog, what do? They do the runaway. What's the runaway? That's the prey running away, making noise, and the dog goes after that. And that's increasing, that will increase. We'll look for how energetic that dog is. And then the other one is the hunt drive, which is basically, the prey drive. And what I teach my class is this: if it's visual, prey drive, there's a bird, there's a rabbit, I got to chase the rabbit. And also the rabbit goes into the thicket. I lost sight of the rabbit. If I want to eat tonight, I got to get that rabbit. So now I got to hunt with my nose. So that is, those are the essential drives that we look at. The play drive, again, is for the stress relief. We want to see how the dog relaxes and plays. It's not aggressive or anything like that with different people. But the prey drive, going after, chasing that prey, we need to see it pronounced so that, we know what we can work with there, and then turn around and look at what it's doing as far as its nose is concerned. How soon does it, click into that hunt drive where it's actually, searching with its nose. And so that's why that's the ones we took. There's also the other drive, there's food drive. You can use food in testing these dogs. A lot of time we use a toy, but you can use food because they're going to search for food. But the thing is that, for lack of that, there's reproductive drive, sex drive, and stuff like that. That's the mm-hmm. drive we don't need.
Yeah, but we don't need to test for that, I don't think. Yeah.
No, we don't need to test for that. No. And so those are the essential drives that we came up with after looking at these things. People talk about the pack drive, being in a pack. Yeah, you can see a little bit of that when you start to see these dogs, especially with handlers at a search and rescue or disaster. They're all part of that pack. There's no fighting going on. Everybody knows, those things. I don't know how you test for those. I know what we look for with hunt drive, prey drive, two essential. And then, like I said, for the stress relief, the play drive, P-L-A-Y. So
then let's jump into that, if you don't mind. Let's do a quick overview of how we test those drives. So let's start with prey. So what's the process that the scale uses to test prey drive?
Yeah, we're going to take, dogs. So let's say it's going to be a toy. It's a ball. It doesn't matter. And what we're going to do is we're just going to throw it. We're going to throw it a pretty good distance. We're going to hold on to the dog and let go. And watch it, how fast it goes out there. We usually do it 10 times. What we've seen and what we found out is that the dogs that go out, when they go out the first time and they go out like an Indy car, you know, they go out after it. And when they do it the 10th time, they're physically in shape to do it. They, you know, I mean, the weather, it can be, you know, and I'll talk about this in a second, but they want to see by the 10th time that they're still going out there with the same energy, the workability, they still have that drive. And I'll give you an example. When we did the testing in Texas many years ago, it was like 2 p.m. It was during the summertime or September. It was hot and humid. And when we saw these dogs going out there, throwing the ball out, it hits the ground, the dog goes after it. The first time, the second time, third time, it's just going out with as much, you know, very, very little of it diminished as far as, you know, going out there and going after that ball. If we want to say, what does a dog look like if it fails? You throw the ball out there, the dog walks out and turns around and comes back. You throw it again, it just stops. Dog doesn't even get excited about it. That's a very low drive. You can't bring the dog's, you know, drive up to the point for making it a search dog at that point. It's just not going to work out.
Okay. So then, so as we think
you're
about
going to hunt drive.
Yeah, well, yeah, we do go to hunt drive, but so I was going to ask for the prey drive. Then is the actual speed important? So if I'm more specific about it, so some dogs just move at a slower speed. So if that dog just generally moves at a slower speed, but that same slower speed is maintained on throw number one as it is on throw number 10, is that still a good candidate?
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
okay.
It's consistently going out there. Yeah. No, we're not asking for the greyhound to go out there. I mean, I work with a male that was a, you know, speed demon. You know, somebody came out with, you know, maybe a golden retriever or something like that, and they kind of lope down there and lope back and lope down there and lope back. But you also are looking, when you're holding on to that dog, when you're looking at that energy level of where is it fixated on? Is it fixated where that prey is going? You have to look at the, you know, kind of the whole demeanor, get a read on that dog. It's all energetic about it. And again, sometimes you want to match up the dog. I mean, I was a male person for many years. David was a male person. But, you know, there's other people with labs out there. Well, I shouldn't say that because labs can pull as hot as any male. But, you know, how they go out there, you want to see that consistency 1 through 10. We use that. Just check, and you can see that if I give you the difference between, you know, something that lopes out there and somebody that runs out there, they're still consistently going out there and doing the work that needs to be done. And now I want to see the energy level. You know, you may run faster than me. Okay. I'm still going to go out there and get the ball. You're going to get the ball. Say, well, you know, Mark's kind of an old man. He's still going out there. He's still energetic about getting the ball, but he's a lot slower than Zephyrin. So,
yeah.
But you're not gonna fail me on my prey drive, so that's what I'm saying. So
all right, very good. So then, if the dog was not toy motivated, ball motivated, could you just throw some food or some treats out there? Would that still work?
Yeah, I guess it could. We can, you know, get these containers of food if it's really food motivated. You want to test the dog's prey drive. It knows that it, you know, if you give it like those snack balls or something, you throw it out there. Mm-hmm. It's not so much a ball; it's that little food that's in there. That is going to give you an indication. I don't like to throw food around at a testing site because if it falls out and the other dog goes, you know, the dogs have that food motivation. But yeah, I don't want to take away anything from the food drive. Dave has always been adamant about this. He's really good about this. He said, if your dog is motivated by food for hunt and for the prey, then we'll use food. I don't think I've ever seen him knock a dog and say, no, that's a food drive dog. We're not going to use it. He's done that. He's definitely would definitely look at that dog and see how it's going out for the food.
Okay. Very good. Let's jump over to hunt drive. Tell us a little bit about that process.
Yeah. Hunt drive. We want to see what the commitment is going into brush. A lot of this stuff, we want to see the dogs going into the brush and using their nose to find that option. We want to see how they go in. You know, once that there's one change that we do, we used to do a no delay. We'd throw something in the brush and release the dog. David and I had a long talk about this. One of the things he's looking at right now is doing a minute. It used to be broken down into immediate release, 15-second release, 30-second release, and then a minute release. And David and I talked about this the last probably a couple of weeks ago, and he was showing me what he's done with the 60-second. And it's worked out just as well. Holding the dog, we're going to throw the toy in. We're going to get the dog's attention, throw it in. I'm going to be watching the dog while that, you know, that ball or that con goes into the woods. You know, have something where the dog has to use its nose. It's high grass. It's into a wooded area. You can't visibly see it. And what it does is it forces, and you can actually see this with a lot of these dogs, is they automatically, they run to where they last saw it move, and then all of a sudden they start working their noses. And that is what we want to see. Sometimes they don't find the ball, but they do go in and they work. And what we're looking for is consistently looking for, rather than coming back to the handler, is staying with that task on hand. And that's what we're evaluating. So if some dog goes out there and it only searches for 2 minutes, you know, but it does a great job of searching, where another dog goes out there for 5 minutes, they're both passing that hunt drive. They are looking with their noses. And it's, the object is not to find the toy. The object is to watch the dog actively working its nose, trying to find that scent of that toy or that, you know, that food article.
Okay. And so again, the focus there is not necessarily finding the toy, but looking for it. So do you care if that dog comes back to the handler? Do you care about the intensity of how that dog looks for the toy, or is it just solely staying in the field and continuing to look for that toy?
No, I'm looking for the intensity. I mean, that's why I if I'll say this, but I love dogs with nice long tails. You can see the demeanor change when the dog is getting close to the tail and everything, but they're working it. And but the intensity with it, they're looking for it, the persistence in staying there. Some dogs are going to be much more methodical about their search. Other dogs are going to go out there and they're going to look, you know, helter-skelter, but you can actually start to see, especially if they are close to the article, you can actually see where they start, you know, working the scent tighter and tighter on the scent cone. And, you know, sometimes they don't come back. And that's a decision when you're testing dogs, say, well, it's dog hunting. Yes, it is. Did it find it? No, it didn't find it. But that is a training issue. That's not a testing issue. Mm-hmm. The testing issue is the dog hunting for it. The training issue is, now I'm going to work with you and teach you how to find, you know, we're going to work together so you can find the odor in the, you know, get close to the odor. That's a training issue. And that's one of the things that, you know, people sometimes say, you know, well, the dog did this and you can do that. You say, that's a training issue that we'll look at later on. Okay. But right now we're testing the dog. What's the dog's raw, you know, performance level on this test?
All right. Very good. So you mentioned high grass. So let's throw out an assumption. All this testing is done in a place that is unknown to the dog. Is that right? And if that is correct, then talk about why that's important.
Yeah. Home field. This actually comes from releasing the dog from home field. This actually goes many, many years ago. Some of the police departments would get calls from people and they say, hey, you know, I've got a German Shepherd. I want to donate to the police department. They say, why? Well, it's a big dog. It's hard to take care of. And oh, by the way, it jumps the fence and goes after my neighbor. And so I actually saw some of these tests and, you know, police officers go over there and they would say, well, the dog's really good because the dog would light up in its home territory. It would be real confident, and, you know, and bark and do all sorts of stuff. And they do a ball test over there. Well, that's the home field. Who plays better at home field? I mean, if the Celtics are playing the Dallas Mavericks, who's going to have the better advantage, the Dallas Mavericks if they're playing in Dallas or the Boston Celtics? Okay, that's a home field for Dallas. Mm-hmm. So that builds kind of almost an artificial crutch for that dog that's being evaluated. You see, you don't really get a perspective on the dog. The thing is all these search dogs, where are they going to go? They're going to be loaded up. They're going to go someplace and they're going to go search. Scott Earhart, who was a police officer out of Maryland, also done a lot of work with dogs. Scott actually got deployed to Turkey one time, and he was speaking in the class, and he said, you know, he said, training the dog, he said, as soon as I hit the ground in Turkey, he said, I knew my dog's search capability was diminished by about 20%. He said it was working at 80% because it was a new territory. But then what he wanted to see, within 24 hours, the dog had adapted to that new territory. And so that's why we want to remove that home field advantage. You're not going to get a true picture at the home field. It's just not going to happen. We brought in a number of dogs from overseas into Houston. They came into Houston, and the kennels were down near the ship channels. And I was watching the dogs when they came in. They were being put in the kennel, and they had this look on them like, you know, if I could leave, I would. But the next day, I went back after 24 hours and saw the dogs all adapted to the area that they were in. They had just gotten transported from overseas into a kennel in the United States and then transported down to Houston and looking at that adaption. So that is why, you know, that's a long answer to your short question. I don't like home field. I'd rather take the dog out someplace where it's not known because I want to get a truer picture of that dog.
All right, very good. So then if you're doing that, do you give the dog, so you go to a new field that the dog has never been to, do you give the dog 5 minutes to acclimate to the situation, or as soon as you get the dog out of the car, you start in testing?
Well, I let the dog go to the bathroom.
Sure. Okay.
Okay. So, all right, no.
Fair enough.
No, I'll give you a good example. I brought a dog into when I was, I got word of a dog up in another state that was being, it was too hard for somebody to handle. And brought the dog in, flew in, major airport, went and picked it up. My wife was with me at the time. And she's just saying, oh, you know, we don't know. Nobody's tested this dog. What's going to happen? I got the dog out of the crate. I don't even know if I went to the bathroom. I took a toy out, sat appointment. This dog just said, I mean, he was ready to go. I mean, he just flown 1,300 miles. It was a strange day. He's at an airport, tall grass, everything was there. I mean, I went, this dog's got it all. I mean, it did. I mean, you could tell just that it got out and it wasn't affected by it all. And it spent, you know, probably 2 years of its life, its first 2 years, up in the same state with the same handler. So, you know, that was, you know, it definitely was not in its home field. So that was good.
So if we look at motivation and drive, at what point are you willing to accept a dog where maybe one is a little bit higher than the other? So, excuse me, not motivation and drive, prey and hunt. And so maybe the prey is a little bit lower, but the hunt is off the chains or vice versa. Is there a balance that you try to strike, or are you just looking for perfection across the board?
No, I'm going to take the drive scores. You know, we're going to add them up, and then we're going to look at the drive testing, we're going to come up with a grade, and the grade is going to be, you know, is it, you know, top of the line. You know, we do an assessment, you know, basically, you know, three being the top or something. And, you know, if it's a 2.6 or 2.8, there's just stuff that you're looking at as you do these dogs. And again, I will say that some people have handled hundreds and hundreds more dogs. They're, you know, like on a hunt drive, you know, if the dog's out there and it finds the ball, is that means that the three, well, what was the intensity when it went out there? It went out there, it hunted, it was real good. It looked nice and solid, 2.5, 2.6 or something to that effect. You know, we're going to give it a numerical value based on the description. All of these things, what I tell people, I want to say something about the testing. What I do is I go out there with a score sheet and I'll sit there and I go, this is what I observed. I don't give it a numerical score when I observe it. I said, this is what I observed. Then I go into the scoring catalog and look at, okay, here's my hunt drive. And I look at the descriptors that we put in there. That's one of the things that we ask people, does this accurately describe a top level hunt drive, you know, 2.7 to 3.0, 2.8. And if it didn't, you know, what is it that it needs or something like that. So that these descriptives of what these values mean are there. So somebody can take their observations. This is real important about the test. You take your observations, you write down your observations, and then you convert it over to your score, your numerical score. Mm-hmm. If you're out there looking at a booklet with all the stuff, you're going to miss a lot of stuff with the dog. Just write down your observation. You know, what is it that you see, and then turn around and then, you know, look at the score that best describes what you've just seen.
So, all right, very
good. I apologize for not talking about that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's great. Let's go ahead and jump to nerve strength. So why is that important? And then how are we proposing to test it?
Yeah, nerve strength, we're dividing up a bunch of variables. We want to look at all the things the dog's going to be exposed to. You know, what kind of surfaces, flick surfaces, auditory, you know, what are they hearing? Or oral, A-U-R-A-L, you know, what are they hearing? You know, loud noises. Fast moving vehicles, all these things that we believe that they're going to come across. How can we isolate them? And then we're going to test for these things. Machinery, loud noise, a lot of metal, a lot of banging, the ability to work, kind of the pro, uh, where is the body in a tight space in a tunnel? There, where it is in dark. A real quick story, there was a dog that made it through explosive dog screening at Lackland, and it was having problems because it was searching at night. It turned out to be night blind. Nobody knew that. Nobody had ever tested it. It had been tested all the time in light, done all the work had been done in light. So what we want to see is the dog, what does dog, does a dog enter in a dark room? That's a visual, nerve strength test. There's going to be other things that go on in there. Maybe it hears a noise or something like that. You can't isolate every variable, but okay, sight, hearing, okay, elevated surface, can we train the dog to do that? We take a young dog, put it on an elevated surface. Dogs don't naturally go on an elevated surface. They have to be trained to it. But what's it look like when it's up there? Is it either, are the claws out? Is it, look like a cat because it's trying to stay on? Is it shaking a little bit? Or is it, moving across, slowly at first. And then we always try to run every nerve strength twice to see if there's an adaption to the stresses. And then if we put it on an elevated surface, bring that dog up the elevated surface. What's it go up the second time? Did it improve or did it decline? If it's declining, now the question is that going to be a training issue, or is that this dog is just never going to be able to do, some of these elevated surfaces? Noise is one of the big things. I went and tested a bunch of hunting labs, and the person had been selling labs to hunters for years and years and years. And I took the labs all into a building and did a noise test in there, not a gunfire test, but to a noise test. And every one of the dogs, hit the door running. They were leaving. Give the dog the opportunity. How does it go in the second time? How does it go into the darkened space? So, you've got sight, you've got the hearing. And I'm going to say something here. We're on this podcast. One of the first things I look at is noise. If you go into any dog catalog, any hunting catalog or any of these things, lightning or thunder, and you have dogs that are afraid of thunder. People can go buy tapes, right? They can do all sorts of training. But think about, you want to get into search and rescue, and you're going to spend 6 months training a dog to deal with loud noise. What we're looking for there is that what is nature versus nurture. Some dogs are very nervous. Loud noise will shut them down. Mm-hmm. And so I will look at that, but I'll give the dog the opportunity. If it completely stresses on that, has that flight response, a lot of times I'll stop the testing right there and not test the dog any further. Because I just feel that, from the noise deal, I could probably teach a dog go on an elevated surface, flick flooring. I don't know if you had the opportunity, but we used to test on, linoleum, take dog in. I've seen dogs that do human remains outside on the grass in the woods. They do great. Do a human remains test inside on slick flooring, and they don't search any longer because they're so nervous about the slick flooring. Mm. So try to isolate those variables. It's not a perfect system. But the other thing is, on the nerve strength test, the dog is not supposed to be in drive. Drive will often compensate for a nerve strength issue. Don't want to see that. I want to see the nerve strength by itself. And we used to do smoke. Some dogs, especially police dogs, come across smoke and stuff like that. That may impact them, but that's not a mandatory test. Noise, slick floor, rough surfaces, elevated surfaces. We make those to be moving vehicles. We make that loud moving vehicles. That's a sight as well as a hearing deal. But trying to see what the dogs do on that. We're looking for, and a lot of times you're on a leash. You're not letting the dog go loose on these nerve strength tests because we don't want that flight response.
Right.
We don't want the dog running off and getting hurt.
So then I want to circle back to some that you mentioned. I've had this conversation with a handful of people, and I think you just kind of confirmed what I've heard from a few people. Specifically around nerve strength to loud noises, it feels like from the conversations I've had that that's just genetic, and no matter how much you work on it, you can never truly get over it. If a dog is really sensitive to loud noises, has that been your experience, or have you seen dogs that have been able to overcome that?
I'm going to agree with you. I think that tends more towards the genetic side of the house. People talk about doing socialization. When I got into Schutzen, I did something. One of the people I got the Schutzen dog from said, "Well, we'll do a gunfire test." That's what they used to do for Schutzen. Mm-hmm. And I went out there and I took my puppy out, and I didn't realize that they wanted me to do it with a 22. I did it with a 45, and dog didn't miss a beat. Of course, when I went back to the breeder, I said, "Yeah," I said, "the dog passed the gunfire test." The dog was like, 3-4 months old. And she said, "What do you use?" I said, "I use my 45. And she went, "Oh my God, what the dog do?" I said, "Didn't bother the dog one bit." So, but I guarantee if I popped it and it was a sound issue, that dog might have, just loped off. But yeah, it wasn't the best test to do. And, 22s are less than 45 rounds, but that's another story. So,
Of course. All right. So now you've gone through all this testing. Now, what does the scoring process look like? Is this a pass-fail test? Is there just a line that you're drawing in the sand, or how do you score it? Is there a balance? Is everything weighed evenly? What does that process look like?
Yeah, they weighted some of the tests a while back, and I saw that, and I said, that was just, I don't want to sit there with a calculator. What I said is, I take my observation, I'll flip my observations, I'll open up the book. And if you haven't done it 1,000 times, like David's done, he didn't look at a book, it's just, I see if the score matches that. And what I'm looking at is, okay, I've got a nerve strength, and then I've got a sociability score, final score, I tally up, I do the drive score, tally that up. And then I've got the nerve strength score. And so out of that, you can have sociability, excellent, a drive, excellent, nerve strength, very good. So if you look at what it comes out is, I color coded the original deal, said excellent, excellent, very good. What is it? I call it potential. I appreciate some of the people that talked to us about this instrument. We weren't saying your dog is going to be, the best search dog in the world. But we also, if it's very good, it's not saying it's not going to be a good search dog. So what I did was the potential. Potential is, the dog has an outstanding potential, an excellent potential, very good, or fair or poor potential for doing search and rescue. That leaves it to the people to make up their mind what they want to do. If they go through and we tell somebody, we evaluate a dog, it has poor potential or fair potential for being a search and rescue or disaster dog or a explosive detection dog. If they're doing that individually, I'm not taking that from a business standpoint. I wouldn't take that. I'm looking for, very good to excellent to outstanding. That's what I want across all those categories. But you may have a dog that's not as sociable, but it's got very good or excellent drive. It's got very, it's got excellent nerve strength. It's not as sociable. What does it do? It growls at people. Well, okay. Now we start matching that up, say, well, what are you evaluating it for? Well, we're evaluating it for police dogs. Okay. Okay, so maybe you make a decision. What happens if the nerve strength is lower, the drive is high, and the nerve strength is lower? The nerve strength is like a good, very good, but the drive is high. Maybe that dog's not going to work out in disaster work because of the potential for noise, moving vehicles, but what about wilderness search? Mm-hmm. So trying to match that up. Thing is that what is it that you're looking for? And when we go back to what we were doing with overseas, I need a drug detection dog that has to work in what we call Oster, challenging, stressed environment, period. That's it. It's a friggin' war zone. So now I've got to get a dog that can operate in a war zone. Where do I want my nerve strength to be? Where do I want my drive to be? Where do I want the sociability to be? So, but that's, you're going to get each one of those values, and you may have a dog. Nerve strength is another issue, is that a lot of times with drive, you mentioned this genetic deal, a lot of times with the drive, you can enhance drive, but we need the basic drive, to motivation to go hunt, the motivation to go after prey, to be there. The nerve strength, sometimes dogs don't volunteer to walk on planks, okay? Even you know, people that get thrown off of pirate ships don't volunteer to walk on plank. Dogs don't either. So now you have to sit there and say, what about training? What can I motivate this dog for training? So that's real important.
All right, very good. So one of the questions I have to ask, because we have a lot of folks on that listen to the podcast that handle bloodhounds, and those are very specific breeds, but how do you think they this scale would apply to them?
I think it would apply good. The only thing with the bloodhound, having met fantastic bloodhound handlers, I don't know what they would do for testing. I wouldn't put the bloodhound through a, you know, prey drive test. I don't know what they're going to do. On the other hand, you know, your hounds, like your beagles, you know, think about the beagles, think about the food dogs or the FDA dogs at the airport, you know, being motivated and being, have the nerve strength to work around moving, you know, moving conveyor belts and jumping up on luggage and being around all those people. So there's your sociability. There's your nerve strength right there. Now, do they use their nose? Sure, they use their nose. So maybe we could do something, design something, because, you know, I've had beagles before. They're a hound, and you'll have a nice prey drive, and they do use their nose, especially for, you know, hunting situations. So I can see that being used. Now, you know, you talk about a specific breed, but one of the best dogs that I saw a couple of years ago at a seminar was somebody got a mixed breed. Oh, my God. You know, I evaluated that dog, and the dog was just, I don't think the young lady who was handling the dog knew what she had. And I said, that's a search dog right there. And that was a combination, you know, Heinz 57, but it had a lot of, you know, hound in it. And so it did everything on the test. I mean, very energetic about prey, hunt, solid on nerve strength. And, you know, if you ask me what breed it was, I couldn't tell you. But, you know, it did really well. But again, the bloodhound situation, I have to defer to the bloodhound people that are out there. I've seen some good bloodhound people. I don't know what they do for testing. I know that I'm not going to make a bloodhound walk a plank. I think that's not going to be a pretty sight. But anyway.
All right. Very good. Very good. So, yeah, this has been a lot of great information. And just so for the listeners, I will post this evaluation. It'll be on the Hunt Find Alert Facebook page. So if you want to go and grab it from there and download it, you are more than welcome. As Mark mentioned, they publish it, and it's 100% free. It's out there and freely available. So if you're interested in using it, reading more about it, you are more than welcome to, again, jump on the Hunt Find Alert Facebook page, and I will have that document there available for you. So, Mark, as we wrap up, what we like to do here is just give you the opportunity to talk about any deployments that you've been on with your patrol dog, and this is just really your opportunity to brag on any memorable searches that you've had with your dogs.
I'll tell a funny story, and it was a good one. And this is when I was in police, and I, you know, Nero was my shepherd, but homicide had called us for a murder suspect, and you know, they'd gone to the house, nobody answered, they wanted me to search the house. You know, it's a high risk search and stuff, and I've got a patrol dog and homicide search, and then go in the house, search the house, there's nothing, and I hear movement up in the attic. Well, I don't know, you know, I don't deploy dogs up to an attic. That's a fatal funnel and stuff like that. But what happened was I pulled down the attic stairs and I yelled up. I said, you know, if you don't come down, I'm going to release the dog. Well, the guy starts moving around. So we hear him going across the rafters and stuff like that. And he heads and he's right in the bedroom. Well, the next thing you know, he fell through the ceiling, the suspect, and he drops. And I always remember my dog was just sitting there. Oh my God, look what's fallen from the sky. and the Nero, to his credit, the guy lands in a bed and there's plaster everywhere. And Nero just jumps up on him on his chest and just sits there. And no bite, just starts growling, barking at him. And I just said, yeah, I said, I wish I had a TikTok video of that or something. But I just sat there and I went, in homicide, hears all this yelling and stuff. And they think, oh my God, something's going on. They come running in. Of course, there's this dog just sitting on the chest of this guy, just staring right in the face. And the guy's got his hands out and he's got plaster all over him. They ask, what happened? Did you send the dog up in the attic? I said, no, I did not send the dog up the attic. And he fell through. That dog later, it wasn't my deployment. I turned it over to my trainer when I left K9. That dog was instrumental in solving finding the body of a kidnapped and killed child. And I thought, and you know, that was, even though I wasn't handling it, it was, you know, that dog had transferred over to another handler, but I was always proud of that dog as far as a street dog was concerned. So it was able to work, find a bad guy, take that bad guy into custody, and then switch gears and then find that human remains of the child that had been, you know, abducted and killed. So I think, to me, that's, you know, that balance of you know, bringing closure to a case and also bringing somebody into custody was, you know, that's what I was really proud of. So.
All right. Good deal. Thank you for sharing that with us. So, final question. If people have questions about the scale, they want to learn how to do it, maybe they want to dig a little bit more into it, can they reach out to you? And if so, how can they go about doing that?
Yeah, they can. Yeah, sure, can reach out to me. I first of all, I'll give you my cell phone. I don't mind doing that. Area code 859-466-0514. I've got an old AOL address that I still use, and it's really easy to remember because it's dogmach, DOGMACH, the number one at AOL.com. The reason it's mach, and I'm glad, Zephyrin, you're on the phone, because many, many years ago, I was stationed in Texas, and I called home to my mother, and the operator kept calling me mach, MACH1. So I will never forget that. My mother was like, who is calling? And they go, Mark. And it's because of the Yankee accent. But so I ended up, you know, doing that. So thank the Texans for that, you know, AOL address and the name on that. So yeah, more than happy to discuss it. Anybody has anything to add to it? I don't care if it's 20 plus years old. You know, David and I still talk about it all the time. Anything we can do to it, anything we find. It's a fluid document. We think the foundation is there for anybody that wants to get into search work with the dogs. If they go through and do it and the candidate comes out really, really high, they're going to have a really good search dog.
All right. Very good. Well, Mark, we really greatly appreciate your time. This has been a great episode. And for the folks listening, the assumption that I make is that all SAR teams are doing some type of evaluation on your dog. And so if you are, that's great. If you're not, then perhaps this is the kick in the butt to start doing that. But this scale is really great. We've, again, as I mentioned earlier, we've been using it for the last few years, and it's been pretty accurate on the assessment of the dogs that we've used it on. So really appreciate you and David taking the time to put it together. And we're grateful for you being here on the episode. And so with that being said, thank you all for joining Hunt, Find, Alert. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time. In the meantime, safe searching.